Hello, my friends. This is Kevin Swanson, and I wanted to give you the heads up. The good Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. I'm coming back January 26th. For the last 11 years, we've aired the Generations radio broadcast from my basement out here in the eastern plains of Colorado. We have chronicled the demise of Western civilization as we sit on the frontier edge of the West during some of the key moments in history. We have built the emergency life rafts. We have called for repentance on the salient sins of the day and pointed to the cross of Jesus Christ as our only hope. We have warned of cultural giants that pave the way to apostasy for our children and grandchildren. We have supported great ministries like Candle in the Window, ChristianFamilyElderCare.org, HSLDA, Heritage Defense, Teen Pack, the NCFIC, Reformation Heritage, Samaritan Healthcare, and 100 other great ministries. There are a lot of good people out there contributing to the solutions. We have worked hard to maintain a strong unity amongst the good guys while taking down the bad ideas that are corrupting our world and undermining faith, family, and freedom. Well, in the meantime, my friends, Bill Jack, Steve Vaughn, and Adam McManus will keep you updated on the issues and the interviews that define our times. I am taking a break for my family and for the restoration of body and soul, so we would appreciate your prayers. If you would like to send my family a message, please send it to host@kevinswanson.com, and thank you for your support. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your encouragements and the iron that sharpens iron. I hope to connect with you all again towards the end of January.
I'm Adam McManus, in today for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations with Vision. Welcome to part two of my conversation with Timothy Mahoney, the director of a new documentary, 2 hours in length, called Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, coming out Monday, January 19th, in 650 theaters at 7 p.m. local time. You can see the trailer and learn more about it at patternsofevidence.com. That's patternsofevidence.com. James Hoffmeyer, an Egyptologist, said that there are clearly important reasons why God chose the plagues as he did, to begin with the Nile and end toward the end with the sun, the ninth plague. What was God saying, interestingly, to the Egyptians and to Pharaoh himself?
According to James Hoffmeyer, what he saw was that God was showing Pharaoh who was in control. That it wasn't the Nile, it wasn't the sun god, it wasn't any of these other gods, but there was a battle between God and the deities of Egypt.
You got a chance to interview the prime minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. Most of us think of him as a political figure, as Michael Medved said, a nationally syndicated Jewish talk show host, but he's also an author and historian. And this is what he said, and I just love it. He said, "Moses was the greatest revolutionary of all time. Remember that in antiquity, there were grand empires that were based on one principle, and that is slavery. And Moses challenged that twice. He challenged it by taking his people who were slaves in bondage in Egypt and freed them, taking them to the promised land. But he also challenged it by providing a moral code for mankind that said it is not the king or the emperor that decides the law. There is a higher law. And these were absolutely revolutionary ideas." What was it like, Timothy, to sit in Benjamin Netanyahu's presence and hear him kind of bring the scriptural stories to life as he did?
It was quite an amazing experience, because here's this person who you've heard about and I've seen. I actually sat across from him at his desk at the time. When I interviewed him, he was right between, he had been prime minister, was right prior to his second time of becoming prime minister. So I probably had more access to him. I was only supposed to talk to him for about 15 minutes. I connected with him. I had spent 2 days preparing for the interview. When I met with him, he started telling me a story about his family, and I knew who his grandfather was. When I connected with him that way, all of a sudden our interview went to another level.
Israel Finkelstein, a noted Israeli archaeologist and the author of The Bible Unearthed, has argued that the Exodus did not happen in the manner described in the Bible. And as we talked about last time in our first conversation, the major problem is that they are mainstream archaeologists of today concluding that the Exodus occurred during the New Kingdom, one of three periods of Egyptian history, instead of the Middle Period. Is that the basic sum?
The story of the Exodus happened over, some people say 400 years, others say 215 or so. There's this period of time when they're trying to look at the time of slavery. What was the length of that time? Finkelstein is taking what pretty much every Egyptologist or archaeologists has assumed now in mainstream, is that if an exodus happened, it happened in what they call the 13th century. It would have been in the time period of Rams, and that is in what's called the Middle Kingdom of Egypt.
Rabbi Wolpe, a very influential rabbi in America, has one of the largest Jewish congregations, was interviewed by Michael Medved and made some pretty ridiculous claims, all of which based upon the work of Israel Finkelstein, this, I think, confused archaeologist. Wolpe said, the idea of the Exodus and the Revelation, however you configure it, is central to the Jewish tradition. But I think that doesn't mean that you have to believe that the Torah gives an historical account of it. I don't think the Torah is a book of facts. It's a book of meaning. What on earth is he talking about?
Well, I think in the next line he says, things can be truths that aren't facts. And I think what he's trying to say is that there's a power to the story, there's a power to the idea, and that can be a truth, but it doesn't mean that those events actually had to have happened.
In your film, Patterns of Evidence, you point to this unbelievable judgment of God against the Egyptians. They lost their agriculture as a result of the dead fish, dead cattle, and hail through the Nile turning into blood, the cattle being slaughtered by God, and the hail that crushed the crops, the loss of their firstborn sons in that 10th plague as a result of the angel of death, the loss of their slave force as the slaves, the Jews, crossed the desert and escaped through the Red Sea, and then the loss of the army as the Jews, led by Moses, walked through the parted Red Sea, and then God closed the Red Sea upon Pharaoh and the army. I mean, that is a 1, 2, 3, 4 punch in the gut that left Egypt very vulnerable to outside foreign forces that wanted to capitalize on their weakness.
Yes, if the word got out that those events had happened, and Egypt always had threat around it from the south, what we call Nubians, you know, from the west, from the northeast, those events actually happened, then Egypt, like you said, would have been very vulnerable. So the question then was, what time in history did Egypt collapse?
And you believe it collapsed when?
Between the Middle Kingdom and the New Kingdom is a period called the Second Intermediate Period. It's when there's not much known, but it's a time when what people believe is that Egypt was invaded by foreigners.
Tim Mahoney, you went to Holland to meet the curator of the Leiden Museum, where a significant papyrus is housed, extra-biblical evidence of the plagues and the calamities that the Egyptians endured, written by an Egyptian. What was the scribe's name, and what was the papyrus called?
The scribe's name was Four, and the papyrus was called the Admonitions of an Egyptian Sage. A lot of people have been interested in it because there are elements within this document that actually mirror the story of the plagues.
It is really astounding. For example, we read in Exodus 4:9, to convince Pharaoh, God said, take some water from the Nile, pour it on the ground, and as it hits the ground, it will turn into blood. The Egyptian writer says, behold, Egypt is fallen to the pouring of water, and he who poured water on the ground seizes the mighty in misery. Then in Exodus 7:20-21, we read, and all the water in the Nile turned into blood, and the fish of the Nile died, and the Nile reeked, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. The Egyptian wrote, the river is blood. If you drink of it, you lose your humanity and thirst for water. Then in Exodus 9:6-23-31, all the livestock of the Egyptians died. Fire ran down from heaven, and the Lord sent hail upon the land. Even the flax and the barley were smitten. The Egyptians said, gone is the barley of abundance. Food supplies are running short. The nobles hunger and suffer. Those who had shelter are in the dark of the storm. And finally, the Exodus 12:29 passage, at midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh sitting on his throne to the firstborn of the captive in the dungeon. The Egyptian writes, behold, plague sweeps the land. Blood is everywhere, with no shortage of the dead. He who buries his brother in the ground is everywhere. Woe is me for the grief of this time. It's incredible, the mirror between the biblical account and the Egyptian scribe who documented what he saw.
It is. I think that one is the probability And what some people would say, well, this was just poetic, but it sounds as if Egypt was in chaos. And that's what people looked at was, well, when would you see this? But what's interesting is it goes back to this pattern of evidence in a correct sequence. Remember, you see the arrival, you see the character of Joseph, you see the multiplication, you see slavery, and then you see this issue of judgment. And they're all happening in the Middle Kingdom.
My guest is Timothy Mahoney. He is the producer, director of Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus. It'll come out Monday, January 19th in 650 theaters at 7 p.m. local time. Make sure to put it on your calendar. You can visit the website, patternsofevidence.com. Patternsofevidence.com. Why did the influential Egyptologist, the late Miriam Lichtheim, rule out, though, the possibility that this Egyptian papyrus, the admonitions of Ippur, referred to a real national calamity like the Ten Plagues?
Well, what's interesting is that she said, well, how in the world could this have happened? It's contradictory, because on one hand, the land is said to suffer from total want, but on the other hand, the poor are described as becoming rich and wearing fine clothes, and generally,
That's just so funny to hear, isn't it?
Had.
Oh, that's funny.
But guess what? That's exactly what the text said happened.
The slave takes what he finds, the gold, the silver, the turquoise strung on the necks of female slaves. That's right from the Egyptian writing and right from the biblical text. God said, you will ask the Egyptians to give you what you want, and they will give it to you, because they just wanted the Jewish slaves to get out of their land because they had become an absolute curse to the nation.
Right. That's what the text says. So Miriam Lichtheim, I don't know if she actually knew what the biblical text said as clearly as and maybe really saw how well it matched. But once again, Egyptologists have dismissed this because it's earlier in time. It's in this Middle Kingdom.
You note in your voiceover, was this just another coincidence that this document, the Egyptian papyrus that we've referenced that's so interesting, that documents the plagues from an Egyptian perspective, was originally composed in the only period when Egypt's delta was dominated by large numbers of Semites? I think it's a clear indication that the Exodus did occur in that middle time period, that middle kingdom, as it were.
Well, it sure is convincing in a way that there's so much connected to it. You've got to have all six events. If you have six events, where do they show up? Not just one event or two events, but all six. And are they in the right sequence? And that's what this film tries to show, and then we let people decide for themselves.
The six events to which you refer, the arrival of Abraham's descendants in Egypt, their multiplication, their descent into slavery, the judgment of the nation that enslaved them, the exodus out of Egypt, and finally in Canaan, the conquest of the promised land. David Roll took you to see a replica of a monument erected just a few years after Pharaoh Ramses' death by his son. What's important about what you learned there?
According to this monument, it's a poem, and it's talking about the conquest of this kingdom. And Merneptah is one of the many sons, but the son that basically followed Ramses. It's a poem, by the way. It's talking about nations, and it's talking about cities. In that list, it says that Israel, it identifies Israel. And why is that significant is that if the Exodus would have happened in the time of Ramses, Israel wouldn't have been a nation. They would have just still been tribes.
Wow. And that's the only time that we see the name Israel on an Egyptian monument anywhere, isn't it?
There's another identification which we filmed with Dr. Ayling, and it's the Berlin pedestal. There's another mention of the name Israel as a nation on an Egyptian monument, and that is fascinating, and it's even 100 years earlier than the time of Ramses. It's defining or showing that Israel was in the land and considered a nation way before the time of Ramses.
Your narrator says this monument does not fit the idea of Ramses being the pharaoh of the Exodus because it was written shortly after his death, and it recognizes Israel already existing in Canaan in the Promised Land, is one of the significant powers of the day. And that shouldn't be, because the Bible says that the Israelites did not even begin to conquer Canaan until 40 years after the Exodus. So, again, I think what's so helpful about your film, Patterns of Evidence, 2 hours in length, Timothy Mahoney, is that you are taking a fresh look at the timeline and pointing to the absurdity that there is no archaeological evidence for the Exodus if you're looking in the wrong time frame.
That's correct. And I think that this has been a problem that no one's really been able to deal with. We just started to take a practical look at it and said, well, if you were going to look for this, how would you go about doing that? So what I was doing was finding archaeologists and Egyptologists who had contributed to some of this, but they hadn't been really collated and put together in a way that people could take it in. And that's what Patterns of Evidence, the Exodus, does, is it really the wall of time helping people to digest all this information and understand what the story is. That's why people are excited about the film.
Part of that wall of time has to do with Solomon's Temple. We'll talk about that when we return. I'm Adam McManus. You're listening to a conversation with Timothy Mahoney, filmmaker of Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, out Monday, January 19th in 650 theaters at 7 p.m. local time. Visit the website to look at the trailer and to learn more. PatternsofEvidence.com. PatternsofEvidence.com. I'm Adam McManus in today for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations with Vision.
Oh, my, Pam, Drew. Oh, ever since your father died, I'm just having trouble living here alone.
Mom, I guess you're right. We do need to find a place that can take care of you. But they just built that new fancy-looking assisted living place, and I'm sure you'd love it there, right?
But, Drew, how much would that cost, and isn't that like 50 minutes from either of us?
Yeah, I know, but Mom's got money, and I'm sure there's plenty of people there that would keep her company.
Oh, yeah, but spend Mom's every last dime, and sure, there are people there, but nobody she knows. Mom, we've been praying about it, and well, we want you to live with our family.
What? Pam, no
way.
Oh,
Pam, no. I don't want to burden you, and I could never. You have children to care for. Mom, we love you, and yes, it may take some adjusting, even changes, but we want to honor you this way.
Really, Pam, you think you can do it?
But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God.
Christian Family Elder Care. Restoring honor, thriving as caregivers. Visit ChristianFamilyElderCare.org.
Welcome back to Generations with Vision. I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson. You can learn more about me at my website, adammcmanus.net, mcmanus.net. Shoot me an email with your feedback to this particular broadcast or even suggestions for topics or guests for future broadcasts, as I'm one of three co-hosts filling in for Kevin through the end of January. My email address, talkradioadam@gmail.com. TalkRadioAdam@gmail.com. Talking with Timothy Mahoney in part two of a two-part conversation about his new film that will be released Monday, January 19th, 650 theaters at 7 p.m. local time, called Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus. You can learn more and take a look at the trailer at the website PatternsofEvidence.com. Most scholars, your narrator notes, agree that Solomon began his reign in 970 B.C., so 480 years before this would place the Exodus around 1450 B.C., 200 years before the most agreed upon by mainstream scholars as the Ramesses date. Yet the popular view continues to be that the Exodus occurred in the time of Ramesses. Why is there such a reluctance among all these mainstream archaeologists?
I'm going to basically give my own ideas. I'm sure that part of it is that probably very famous Egyptologists in the past have said, well, listen, this is what the text says. If that's what the text says, then that's what we're going with. They don't really look at the other texts to basically see any difference. People who believe in the Bible, they do go to the 1450 date and say, wait a minute, you're not going to find the Exodus in 1250. You're going to find it in 1450, because this is what the Bible is saying. There's a sort of a stubbornness among mainstream scholars to say, no, it's only happening here. And then other biblical theologians at the 1450 are saying, no, it's got to be over here. But there's a problem, because it's hard to find evidence in either of those areas.
I was intrigued to learn about the fact that goods were found in the streets and houses of one of the Semitic settlements in Egypt, left exactly where they were before being buried by the sands of the desert. This indicates a last-minute, not-prepared-for exodus or leaving of that location for presumably the Promised Land, doesn't it?
It matches the story again. What did the story say? So what we did is we said, what is the text saying? What can we draw from that? And you're talking about a settlement which is 120 miles south of Avaris. It matches the sort of abandonment that we see at Avaris. At this settlement, they found out it was a slave settlement and that everybody just left quickly.
Let's talk about Jericho, the fall of Jericho. We know it well from Sunday school and our own reading of it as adults. They encircled the city of Jericho seven times and blew their trumpets on that seventh day, and the walls of Jericho came tumbling down, and they were able to conquer the city of Jericho after Joshua having sent in some spies and met with the harlot Rahab, who had hidden them, lied about having hidden the spies, and they promised that they would not hurt her or her family. So let's break down what the patterns of evidence show about the destruction of the city of Jericho. There was a woman named Kathleen Kenyon who dug at the Jericho site in the 1950s. What did she conclude?
She basically said that it was clear that this city had, the walls had fallen down, and that the city was burnt, which matched the story of the Exodus. But what she said, which disturbed a lot of people, was that she said that this destruction happened around 1550 BC. So 100 years before the 1450 Exodus date, that some scholars believe, and 300 years before the Ramesses Exodus date. That sent a shudder throughout the world that, hey, if Jericho didn't happen, if this didn't happen at that time period, then there's probably no conquest.
David Roll says, by contrast, if people are telling us there is no Jericho at the time Joshua conquered the Promised Land, and therefore Joshua is a piece of fiction, and therefore the conquest is a piece of fiction, and then probably Exodus is a piece of fiction as well, if that's the case, why don't we ask the simple question, well, when was Jericho around? When was Jericho destroyed? And start from that point of view, which I think are excellent questions. What did you discover?
Bryant Wood suggests that Kenyon misstated the pottery. And then there's another group that say, no, Kenyon was right, and that the conquest actually happened earlier. And what David Roll and John Vinson suggest, Vinson is a scholar from England, is that all the cities that were to be conquered during the time of the conquest, they all existed in that Middle Bronze Age. And then something happened where all of them were taken down. Something happened in the area of Canaan where these cities were all gone. And then that brought in this second intermediate period. So not only was Egypt in a state of ruin, but the cities like Jericho and other cities were destroyed at the same, within like 40 years later.
And the fact
this matches the story of the Exodus.
The fact that the walls of Jericho came down is not seemingly impressive at first blush if you don't know how impressive their walls and their defense system really was. Your narrator says, excavators found that Jericho was protected by a brilliant defensive system. At its base, a stone retaining wall more than 15 feet high with a defensive extension wall of mud bricks rising higher still. Beyond this was the rampart, a very steep slope covered with a slick surface of white plaster where attackers would have been exposed to arrows and sling stones from above. And on the top of that rampart was the main city wall, also made of mud brick, more than 25 feet high and 10 feet thick. So how tall was the entire Jericho wall from the actual ground to its height? It must have been 50 feet, 75 feet, pretty tall.
Yeah, probably. So the upper wall actually fell down the glassy slope and ended up down at the bottom, and that basically created a way for people to run up into the city.
Your storyteller, who is the Orthodox Jewish rabbi who is summarizing scripture or reading directly from scripture, says, imagine the dread and the desperate panic of the people of Jericho. Day after day, for 6 days, the people of Israel walking around their city with the Ark of the Covenant, the sounding of ram's horns. On the seventh day, they encircle the city 7 times, and the priests give a long blast on their horns. The people let loose with a mighty shout, and the walls come tumbling down. I would think that the reason why they were filled with dread, which he doesn't reference, is that they had heard about the 10 plagues of God against Egypt, and they had heard about God parting the Red Sea when Moses raised his staff, and they had heard about the drowning of the Pharaoh and the Pharaoh's army, and they were frightened.
Well, I think actually the biblical text states something to that effect, that Rahab had actually stated that, this woman who helped the spies that came into the city, and she hid them. This woman said, we had heard about these things.
Yes.
So you're right. The word was out.
Another pattern of evidence emerges in your film, Timothy Mahoney, when you look at the jars of the people that lived in Jericho that had been excavated, still full of grain. If there had been a long struggle, long besiege against their walls, and not a quick wall fall on the seventh day that they surrounded the city, they would have eaten through most of their grain, wouldn't they?
That's correct. I actually talked with Brian Wood, an archaeologist, about this, and he said, when did the Passover happen? It happened in the spring of the year, and there was a harvest. There was grain that came in. And what's very interesting is there are two parts to this. One is that the siege wasn't long, because, like, as you said, the grain was there. It was in jars. But then why was the grain left? Because that was the big question. That's another unique piece to this information. According to the biblical story, they weren't supposed to take anything like the grain. It was an offering to God, this whole
city. You mean the Jewish conquerors?
Correct.
Because they had been told by Joshua, do not take anything of value. Do not take any animals. Do not take gold and silver. Do not take food and clothing.
Because this city was an offering. And so normally grain is like, gold. I mean, you would take it because you could eat it yourself and you could trade with it. You could do a lot of things. So if the city had its grain, why wasn't it taken?
The other interesting aspect to the Jericho story in terms of the patterns of evidence is how on earth would Rahab and her family have survived the crumbling of the wall at God's impetus? Talk about the evidence in that regard.
There's a German excavator who I found fascinating. His name is Ernst Sellen. And he conducted the first major excavation at the site. And he had detailed plans and photographs. And I actually was able to find a book of his in Jerusalem and was able to look at what he had done. It was just amazing.
I understand he published it back in 1913.
That's correct. And he basically showed that on the north side of the city, there were houses that were built into the rampart, this lower city wall. Between the lower city and upper wall, there were houses there. Obviously, the story was that Rahab had the spies, and she let them out of her window, and they went down the wall. So he found that in this one particular area, there were still houses that were standing. It matched the story of Rahab's house not being destroyed.
And that it's unusual that the houses were built into the wall. Most houses were not part of the wall. They were inside the wall. I mean, they were inside. The wall was its own structure. The houses were separate structures.
The majority of the houses, obviously, were inside the city. But in her particular case, remember, she was a prostitute. She was maybe living in this outer side of the city on the lower wall. This house was remaining when the excavators uncovered it.
She, according to the biblical account, marked her home with a scarlet cord as the one that God and the Jews were to remember to spare. And they lived up, God and the Jews lived up to their end of the bargain. There is archaeological evidence that the city of Jericho, the walls fell first, and then the burning occurred. I don't know exactly how archaeologists can draw that particular conclusion, but it certainly matches the biblical record.
Yes, I'm not exactly sure how they know that as well, but that is exactly what they found. And they found that the city had collapsed, and then it was set on fire. And I think Kathleen Kenyon thought that maybe it was the Egyptians. And Brian Wood said that there was no record of that type of activity happening then.
There's another example of the biblical record matching up with a pattern of evidence, as you point to in your film, Patterns of Evidence, Timothy Mahoney, in which Joshua turned northward and headed for the city of Hazor. Tell me about what the Bible says and what the evidence shows.
This particular city was also destroyed in a similar manner that they found with Jericho. But what's interesting is that according to the story of the Bible, when Joshua went to the city, he turned north and there's a king by the name of Jabin, king of Hazor, and he gathered all the kings of the region against Israel. And Joshua captured this city and struck the king with a sword, and then he set the city on fire. So what did the Israeli archaeologists find? They found a massive burn layer, very much like the Jericho destruction. And they found tablets. At what time do you think they found them? At the Middle Bronze Age, when all this activity is happening, that belonged to a king with the name Jabin. Mm. That's the name of the king that Joshua actually struck with a sword. So the question is this the same king? What David Roll is saying is that this matched the very name that the Bible had stated was the name of the king that Joshua had killed during the time of taking over Hazor.
John Bimson, one of your experts, said when you put those cities side by side, the biblical account and the archaeology match extremely well. I think we have enough destroyed and abandoned cities to say this fits the sequence of events the Bible's describing. There's a high probability that what we're looking at here is Joshua's conquest of the Promised Land. That's pretty exciting stuff.
It really is. If you're willing to look for this pattern, and if you're open to seeing the pattern in a place where it's not accepted. But there's reasons. And that's what the film does, is it basically then says, well, why is all this evidence showing up in an earlier time period?
The German explorer Ernst Sellen of the city of Jericho back in 1913 had uncovered huge stones of a fortification wall behind which a great two-tower temple had been erected. And he'd uncovered the biblical tower of Shechem. Joshua, according to the Bible, set up a great stone under an oak by the sanctuary of the Lord to renew the covenant that God had made with Israel at Mount Sinai. And Joshua said to the people, "Choose this day whom you will serve, the Lord or other gods. This stone will be a witness against us, for it has heard all the words of the Lord that he spoke to us. It will be a witness against you, lest you deny your God." Interestingly, Ernst Sellen, the German excavator, found what he believed was that very stone and put it in that position, erecting it where it would have been in front of the temple. The subsequent German excavator, who disagreed with Sellen's conclusions that this was the city of Jericho to which the Bible referred, actually did something dramatic with the stone. What did he do?
Well, he was upset. I think what Ernst Sellen basically was saying is that this site, he believed, was a religious site. He thought there was a temple, and he thought that this stone was the main religious symbol at the site. Obviously, he knew the story, but at this time, remember, there's a lot of criticism about the Bible, and because Ernst Sellen suggested that there was this connection, he was dismissed from this, and the other person who came along, the next manager of this site, basically was so angry that he dislodged this artifact, really, massive stone, and threw it into a dump where they were throwing the remains, and he broke the stone. Later on, archaeologists came back, and guess what? They were able to recover that stone and the base, and they fitted the stone back into the base, but they could not find the remains of the stone.
You have all these patterns of evidence, Timothy Mahoney, in your film, Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus. You present it to one of the mainstream archaeological experts, Israel Finkelstein, who does not think there's any evidence for the Exodus. And he says, look, we might be wrong 10 years here, 10 years there, but there's no way to change, to shift centuries. I mean, forget it. I think that we are, the archaeologists who disagree with you, are on solid ground, so there's no need to look for different centuries. Sounds like Israel Finkelstein is in major denial to me.
Israel Finkelstein and the rest of the scholarly world has pretty much accepted this chronology that we have. But what's very interesting is there's more to this story. There's more to these patterns. If you're going to question the Bible and the stories of the Bible, can I question everything? How do we know that Egypt's history was founded on the right timelines? What is it that synchronized their history? What David Roll and others are saying is that as you learn more about something, you gather more information, you make corrections.
Exactly. John Bimson himself says, Egyptian chronology has been assumed to be fixed now for a very long period of time, so the whole idea of taking it apart and starting again is anathema to most Egyptologists.
Correct. There are challenges. The film's not about correcting it. It's just identifying the fact that there are challenges. We don't necessarily know everything about history that we think we do. As archaeology uncovers more things, they gather more information. Just recently, there was a whole, I believe, dynasty that was just found. You add to your information. That's what this story is about. What if Egypt's history is off, and these findings, which are earlier in time, actually would slide up in history and become contemporary with the story of the Bible?
I love how it concludes. The last line of your documentary, 2 hours in length, Patterns of Evidence, out Monday, January 19th, in 650 theaters at 7 p.m. local time. You write, after the Israelites left Egypt, it is written they miraculously crossed a mighty sea and traveled on to Mount Sinai. No trace of their journey has ever been found. But if there really was an exodus, then the mountain was somewhere out there. And then it fades to black. It would seem, Timothy, that you're pointing to the next patterns of evidence related to Mount Sinai.
That's correct.
I picked up on your clue, didn't I?
You did. I try not to be too obvious, but yes, there's a lot more to patterns of evidence. And we actually had spent an enormous amount of time looking for the route of the exodus. Where did they go? What sea did they cross? What mountain did they go to? And then, most importantly, what happened at that mountain that changed the history of the world?
This took 12 years for you to put together, do the research, do the filming, have the animation done. Why so long?
Well, I think actually there was an awful lot of learning that had to be done. There was a period of time where we were going searching for a lot of different pieces of information in a lot of different directions. But actually, this particular film really took about 2 years to put together. It was the first 10 years of becoming familiar, meeting more people, understanding the concepts. That was just sort of our growing up period.
Mm.
And now I believe that we can unfold a lot more information a lot faster, because now we have a much better idea as to where patterns of evidence should go. And we've created a lot of tools and relationships. We have the ideas for the future films, actually, that will come out of this.
You're going to have a 30-minute pre-show on Monday, January 19th. At 6:30 p.m., when exclusive content will be released on the silver screen. And then following the presentation of the film, Gretchen Carlson of The Real Story with Gretchen Carlson will be hosting a panel discussion.
We're going to have Dennis Prager, national radio host. He's Jewish, and he's spoken and written quite a bit about the Exodus. Eric Metaxas, he's speaking about Christianity and the culture today. They're going to talk about, what does this story mean? What does it mean today?
I love what your executive producer, David Westner, said. This is not a puffy documentary. It's an entertaining presentation of a boatload of scientific and historical facts which shed new, important light on this ancient but most important story. And I must say, speaking personally, that as a Christian since the age of 7, I felt my faith very much affirmed and encouraged as I watched it. I appreciated your fairness and your willingness to provide both sides of the argument. And I ultimately drew the conclusion myself that the evidence does indeed stack up and point to the biblical account. And it was just refreshing to know that my faith is well placed.
Well, I'm glad that was the result.
What do you think of the new blockbuster movie, Exodus, Gods and Kings, in light of your research?
I've spent the last 12 years looking for the details of the story and looking for information that related to very specific phrasing and very specific events that happened. So for me, it was just hard for me to connect, because there were so many details of the story that were changed in Exodus, Gods and Kings. You're talking to a guy who spent, and a whole group of other people who've been very focused on, what exactly did it say? So when Hollywood comes along and just sort of creates a new story that doesn't really follow the details, it was just a little bit harder for me to take that in.
Doesn't follow the details, doesn't follow the story much at all, except for maybe the 10 plagues.
Well, basically, it does follow the sense that there were people in Egypt. They were in slavery. There was a character, Moses. There was a Pharaoh. And there was a contest. And then these people leave, and they escaped. But what we found is it's the nuances of the information that reveal an awful lot. And in this particular case with that film, there wasn't any regard for that. And so I think that's the reason why, for some people, it's just not as interesting to them. What I was trying to do is to say, did this story happen or not? Here is exactly what the story is saying happened. And that's what Patterns of Evidence does. It basically looks at it seriously and then talks to people on both sides of the equation. And all I wanted to know was, what is the truth? And the bottom line, I say, isn't that what faith and science should be doing, is a search for truth?
Timothy Mahoney, director of Patterns of Evidence, The Exodus, has been my guest. The big reveal, Monday, January 19th, 650 theaters nationwide at 7 p.m. local time. Take a look at the trailer, share it on social media, and make sure to go. The website, patternsofevidence.com. That's patternsofevidence.com. I'm Adam McManus for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations with Vision Radio. You can learn more about me at my website, adammcmanus.net, MCMANUS.net. Send me an email with your reaction to this particular podcast, talkradioadam@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, talkradioadam@gmail.com.